Hey, this is Mary. Welcome to Voices of Vets, a podcast where we meet real veterans and hear their stories. All right, Steve, thank you so much for being with us on the Voices of Vets podcast.
I'm glad to be here.
Okay, I'm going to start off with my number one question. Did you serve?
I did.
And what branch did you serve in?
I was in the Air Force.
All right. When did you serve? What years?
Okay, it was August 21st of 1968, and I was discharged on August 20th, 1972, one day less than 4 years.
Why did you choose the Air Force?
Well, it's a funny thing. My dad was drunk all his life, but he was a World War II veteran.
Oh, wow.
And it was just always assumed that we would go off, that, you know, my age group and around, that we would all go in the military. And I remembered him telling me that when it got time to go in the military, that I should probably go in the Air Force or the Navy. Because in times of war, they would have a bed for you, and the Army and the Marines may not.
Oh, wow.
So that was the extent of my choice.
Okay.
So I went with the Air Force because the recruiter was the closest.
Okay. All right. So other than family expectations, what motivated you to join the military, if anything other than that?
Well, I understand the word motivation. It's probably not right, literally. I guess it would be probably figuratively, but I was, it was a very confused time in my life. I didn't have any direction. Didn't know what I was doing. I was in trouble in almost every respect, and it was kind of a way of doing something to get out of where I was.
Okay. All right.
And it was a fast ticket out as well, too. When I went and talked to them, they said, you know, I could go pretty quick. And so that's what I did.
Can you tell me a little bit about your time in boot camp?
Yes. At that time, they put us in a hotel. I'm from Fremont, Nebraska, which turns out to be about 30 miles from the major center in Nebraska, which is Omaha. It's a metropolitan, good-sized metropolitan area. And at least at that time, they housed everybody that was going into the Air Force the next day. They housed us overnight in a hotel in downtown Omaha. They didn't tell us where we were going. I think the Air Force later changed this. But at that time, you were either assigned to basic training in San Antonio, Texas, or Amarillo, Texas. And so the guy I ended up rooming with, I had never seen him before. They put two of us in a room together. Well, we hit it off. Well, we were hoping we would go to the same place, as that stuff often works. They sent me to San Antonio and him to Amarillo.
Oh.
So I went to San Antonio, and basic training was a very rude awakening. I ended up doing very well overall because I was the exercise and the running and all of those things. I aced all of that. I was very good at that.
Okay.
But I had difficulty with things like making the bed and folding correctly and all of that. So a little slower
than
that. But made it through. So I think at that time, I want to say in 1968, the Air Force had the shortest boot camp of the four major branches of the armed forces, and it was 6 weeks.
Mm. So you had 6 weeks to go from being a civilian to being completely ready in the Air Force.
Well, it was yes, they adjust you quickly. It's called a total control environment.
Mm-hmm.
They shave your head. Take all your clothes away, give you, you know, they put me in underwear about 10 sizes too big for me.
Oh my gosh.
All of those things, and marched us, got us up at 4:30 in the morning. It was very hot in San Antonio in August.
Mm.
By about 10 o'clock in the morning, it would be cold at 4:30. It seems strange, but it would be pool out at 4:30 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
By about 10 o'clock, we were all dripping wet.
So tell me, what was your primary job after training, your military occupational specialty?
Okay, now listen to this, Mary. Okay. I was supposed to go to Wichita Falls, Texas, which I did, to learn how to work on airplanes. Well, that was never going to fly.
Because you couldn't even make the bed.
No, and I can't. I mean, you know, I can't. I don't do anything with a car. If I get a flat tire, I'm just down until somebody gets there to change it. Mm. I can't fix anything. So anyway, that school didn't work out. And they, at that time, they threatened you all the time with, if you don't do your school like you're supposed to, the Air Force will turn you into a cook or a military policeman.
Mm.
And that's what they did with me. They turned me in, at least my, I even forget what they call it. It's not MOS like it is in the Army. It's, I think it was AFSC, but it's your job. And they assigned me to food service and sent me to Little Rock, Arkansas.
Were you a good cook?
No.
Okay.
But I'm at least long ways from a cook, Mary. I could stay alive. I know how to boil hot dogs, cook eggs.
But at least nobody would fall out of the sky if you burned the dinner.
No, no. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff you can do in food service without cooking. I mean, mm-hmm. somebody has to clean the dining room and mm-hmm. set it up and all of that. So I did enough to. I was very irresponsible in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Very fortunate to. It's just, I guess one could say now, the grace of God, but just the benevolence and kindness of some people to make it through.
So where did you serve for the majority of your time in, while you were in service?
Okay. I ended up spending, I think I was a total of 6 months in Texas, one full calendar, December to December in Arkansas, one full calendar January to January in Vietnam, and then the last 18 months in Spokane, Washington.
Did, other than Vietnam, were you ever in any other countries?
Well, just getting there and back, we went through, to get to Vietnam, I sent, let's see, where did they send us? Sent me to the Philippines and I think Guam.
Mm-hmm.
And then Saigon, Cameron, Tuiwa was my final place. So, and then coming back, we changed planes in Yokota, Japan, outside of Tokyo, to Honolulu, to Seattle. So just the only other countries I was in was getting to Vietnam and getting home from there. I made a terrible mistake because at that time, you know, you got, I think it was every 6 months, or maybe it was just once a year, but you were given what was called R&R, rest and recuperation. So mm-hmm. you were given a free week, and you could go to, I think, Hawaii and Australia were the main places people went from Vietnam. And, of course, they'd get you there and all of that. So.
Nice.
I didn't, I never had any money to go because I, you know, I irresponsibly used it all staying drunk. So
Oh, no.
I didn't go to Australia or to Hawaii, which we were always told, if you're going to go to Hawaii, you need to go as part of the military because the prices are prohibitive.
Mm.
So I missed my opportunity. I should have went to Australia, I suppose. I didn't. So
what was your favorite place that you lived, where you lived during your service?
That's a tough one. I'll tell you, I liked all of those places. I liked Texas. I still like Texas.
Mm-hmm.
I liked Arkansas and I liked Washington State. In fact, as I always said, that I would live in one of those three places when I got out. And you know the old refrain, it was right back up in Nebraska.
Oh man. So,
but yeah, I liked all of those places. Probably my favorite of those, I suppose, would have been Washington State.
Right.
Spokane is right. It's next to State Line, Idaho. You hear the Quarter Lane. It's just it's a driving distance. You drive over there.
Mm-hmm.
Just a few miles. It's a great part of the country.
OK. Okay. What rank, Steve, what rank are you most proud to have earned? And tell me
Well,
why.
I don't know. I don't, proud is not the right word, Mary. Grateful.
Okay.
Most people at my time were making E4 in 18 months. Mary, I made it for the first time in 47 months.
Oh, so you
And
had
at
some
that
challenges.
time, I think the Air Force has changed their designations. But at that time, E4 was referred to as a buck sergeant. I think they redid those terms, and I think that's an airman first class now, but I'm not sure. I haven't kept up. But E4 was the, it's what's on my DD 214 is my highest rank.
Okay. Did you earn or receive any medals or citations?
Well, I got the service medal for Vietnam.
Okay.
Everybody got that served there. You'll see it on people's sometimes you'll see it on like retired veterans. You probably won't see it on anybody who's still in the military because they wouldn't have been there. It's too long ago. It's what's that medal called? It's the Vietnam Service Medal is what it is. I don't know what it might have another name. I did get a letter while I was in Vietnam saying I would not receive the Good Conduct Medal. I think that came out. I think that was being handed out at 2.5 years of a 4-year enlistment, but I got a letter saying I would not get that, which I never did.
Because of some difficulties.
Yes, I was not practicing good conduct in those days.
I'm sure that's changed.
Well, when I got sober.
So tell me about some of the special people you met.
Well, I'll tell you one very special person I met. I actually talked to his granddaughter a while back. This guy was I don't know. Have you interviewed many people about the military yet? Are you far along in this
Just a
project?
few.
Okay. Is this like for a class or something?
No, this is just to learn more about the veterans around me.
Oh, this is just something you're doing. Okay. Well, then I just maybe could talk a little more openly. Everybody that served in the military knows that chaplains have tremendous power. They have military chaplains come into the armed forces, like in the Air Force, they come in at the rank of captain. And that's a good rank. So they have a lot of pull. But what's not talked about as frequently is medical doctors also. They come in at the least of rank of captain. In my day, some of them were coming in at one higher rank of major because the military has always had trouble retaining doctors to have enough because they have all their own hospitals and all that. Well, they've always had trouble with that. But there was a doctor, he was an ENT doctor who was way back in like 19. When did I get to Spokane? I got to Spokane in February of 1971. So he was there when I got there. He was rebuilding people's noses and all kinds of stuff at that time. And I worked in the hospital dining room where he was assigned to that hospital. So I got to know him very well. Took a big interest in me, tried to get me to straighten up. He literally, Mary, almost single-handedly kept me from getting kicked out of the military. Today, I suppose, if you looked at it, the term isn't tossed around like it was at one time, but you would probably say he enabled me, kept me from, kept me out of trouble. They were getting ready to court-martial me one time and did threaten that, and he called the, I was on my way to see a lawyer, and he called over there and said he was sending a young man over there, which is, wasn't literally true. I was on my way anyway, but he said he wanted me to get priority. And there was a young lawyer captain waiting for me when I got there. And anyway, long story short, they never did court-martial me. They offered me an Article 15, which I refused to sign. So that means they either have to take you to trial or start backing up.
Wait, what's an Article 15?
What's an Article 15? That's a disciplinary procedure where you're sanctioned for some kind of conduct. It will often include the loss of stripes, almost always includes a reduction in rank. So it ends up costing you money. Sometimes they'll put you in jail, stockade. It's not good.
No.
But they decided not to pursue that when I wouldn't sign it. That, I said, well, the lawyer and I devised a plan where I would go to trial, and they decided not to do that. The lawyer actually told me, he never should have said this, I'm sure, but he said that they might convict you, but Sergeant Davis will never have to worry about being promoted again when we're done.
Oh,
The trial, and the reason I got that was because of Dr. Viggy, Major Viggy, calling over there and greasing the slide for me. But
Man.
anyway, he literally kept me from getting kicked out of the military, and I did chase him down and make amends to him some years later. And then a few Christmases ago, I decided to look him up on I don't know what I pulled it all up on my iPad. And so when I called out there, I found this. He was at Jim Rounder actually found him for me back in 1994 when I made amends to him. He looked him up in a book. It was way before all this stuff with social media, but he looked him up in a book at the hospital in Wilson and found that he was in St. Charles, Missouri, which that's where he was from, was St. Louis area. So I made amends to him back in 94, and then I was looked him up and found out he was deceased. But one of his daughters was she's a board certified ENT and had all kinds of accolades, and she's one of the senior practitioners in the clinic that he was one of the founders of. So I actually talked to his granddaughter, who answered the phone when I called, and it was just nice.
That's amazing.
To tell, I wanted somebody to know what I thought maybe his daughter and granddaughter would appreciate knowing what he did for me.
I'm
He
sure.
didn't have to do any of that.
I'm sure they did. Since you were in the food service and kitchen, what was some of the best and worst military food you ate and
Well, here's the thing. The food, you may have noticed the same thing, but it seems to me that food is complained about. It's one of the main things people complain about wherever they go. Like I think that Chinese restaurant you guys all love is just an awful Chinese restaurant. And I eat almost anything, Mary. If I can't eat something, it's bad. I can eat that, but it's just seems way off to me. But anyway, I always found the food in the military good. I spent the majority of my adult work life in the Department of Correction, the prison system. So I made a practice of once a week, all my years in the prison system, I eat in the dining room with the population. So I'd go to the dining room. If there were 100 people in line, I would be 101. I would go all the way through the line, I'd get my food, and I'd sit down wherever there was a place for me in the dining room. And I always found the food fine. The guys always mess with me about eating and thought I was crazy, but they said the reason I thought it was all right is because I only had to eat it when I wanted to. I didn't have to eat it all the time.
In the prison.
But in prison, yeah. But I found the food in the military to be as good as food anywhere else. The thing about it is, if it's not good, it's gotten screwed up after they got there because the government gets the best food available. They get the highest quality. They tell you all that stuff, whatever that is, FDA and all of that. They get the food is fine. So if it's bad, somebody's done not cooking it right or something.
Can you share any memorable experiences or stories from your time in the military?
I can share one that took me years. I think Reed's in a little bit of this boat too of coming to the VA late, but his reasons were different than mine. I was at Cameron Bay in 1970, when I'll try to explain this. They called the living area where I live, they called it a hooch. And what it was a makeshift wood. It was hand built by GIs, and it was just, I was on like the second floor. So it was a walk up building that was just put together, and they called them hooches. And we lived on bunk beds on both floors. Well, in the middle of the night in 1970, the Air Force fights from the air. There's a few exceptions to this, but the Air Force owns the air. All the armed forces have planes and they all fly. But the Air Force owns the air, kind of like the Navy owns the water. And the Marines and the Army own the ground. They all of them are in the air, and probably some of all are, have some stuff in the Navy and the water as well. But the Navy clearly owns the water. Well, we own the air. We probably 20-1. So I was on an area. I don't know how many people were on this, but it would be like a small town. This base I was on in Cam Ranh Bay in South Vietnam. Well, anyway, there were out around on the perimeter, they were called perimeter cops. There were military police out there with machine guns and M16s 24 hours a day. Never, it was always, they were always out there. Out past them in the fields out there were Army infantry, Army Rangers, and Army Green Beret. And then in the air out there somewhere was the Air Force. Well, we would be getting, they called it, we would be getting, we would take rocket fire all the time, and the sirens would go off, and you could hear them hit. So when the sirens would go off, depending on what the siren was, you would, it would tell you what to do. Most of the time, the first thing you do would be hit the ground, because shrapnel explodes. So the higher you're standing, the more likely chance you have of getting caught. Well, here's what happened in the middle of the night in Cam Ranh Bay. The POL was blown up, which is the fuel depot. So all of a sudden, in the middle of the night, you could see from Cam Ranh Bay, Southeast Asia. You could, hell, you could probably see the Rocky Mount with that level of all of a sudden. I mean, it's just the it's on fire. Well, this guy, and I'm on the second floor, remember, and so the, all these sirens are going off, and you can imagine it's pandemonium. We're all asleep. I'm drunk, passed out. Well, this guy gets up and starts running right down the middle of the hall. So this would be like a big dorm in a college somewhere on the second floor. So he's screaming, "We're dead, we're all gonna die, this is where we die," and he's
Oh
just
my
he's
gosh.
panicked. Well, somebody jumped out and cold cocked him. They just want somebody across from where I live. I never did. I don't know who hit him, but some just a GI living across the open bay from me just jumped out and cold cocked him, knocked him out. Just like, I don't think Muhammad Ali ever hit anybody harder, and that guy hit him, and they drug him under a bed. That's where he stayed.
Oh my gosh.
So anyway, all kinds of pandemonium. Well, what that guy said made sense with what we knew, because what that would have meant, if we thought the Viet Cong had blew it up, right? Had they blown it up, that meant we had been compromised, because there's all these layers of protection before they can get to us, because we got the Air Force out there in the air, we got Green Berets, Rangers, and infantry out there in the, what was called the boonies. We call it the boonies, but it's the jungle. They're out there, and then there was perimeter cops all around protecting the perimeter with cannons, machine guns, and M16s. So if the Viet Cong did that, then we are on our way to death, because there'd be no reason for the Viet Cong to stop, because they've already compromised everybody. Follow me? We're all, everybody out there has not been able to maintain what they were responsible for. So I thought that all these years. In fact, I never said anything about it, but about, I don't know, a few years ago, I actually said that out loud, that I was there when that happened. I'd never said that before. I'd never said it to anybody. Well, because I, in a long story short, you know, the all the Veterans Day celebrations we have now. You can eat yourself sick.
Yeah.
Restaurants feed, tons of them feed you free.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that started with the Golden Corral. They started feeding veterans free. And so in 2018, I was in the serving line in Raleigh at a Golden Corral. They've got a, like, they have a helicopter in the parking lot. And there's all these veterans organizations and all of this stuff. Well, I never paid any attention to it. I'd seen them all before. This guy, turns out his name was Angel, was he was sitting at a desk when you turn the line. You're in the line inside the Golden Corral,
mm-hmm.
going through the line. And so he walks right up to me. I'm just in the line like everybody else. He walks right up to me and said, "Are you on the registry for Vietnam?" I said, "No, man, I'm not interested in any of that." And they have, you know, for years, people have, they've tried to get Vietnam veterans to go through the process of all the stuff to find out what you might be eligible for. Well, I never wanted to do it. So I just never did. And I said, "No, I'm not going to do that." He said, "Oh, you're going to do it. You're going to come and see me." I said, mm-hmm. "I appreciate it, but I'm not." It wasn't adversarial. It was more like he was a character.
Mm-hmm.
So he was not a professional employee at a veterans center. What he was, well, it'd be like this, Mary. It'd be the difference between like a treatment center employee and an AA member, okay?
Mm-hmm.
He was a volunteer at a Disabled American Veterans Center in Raleigh. And he said, "You need to come and see me. I want you to come and see me on a Monday morning. We get there about 8:30. I want you to come about 10 o'clock. So it'll start to slow down. And you put my name down that you're there to see me." And I said, "No, I just rather not do that." He said, "No, you need to do it."
How did he identify you?
Huh?
How did he know you were a vet?
I had my hat on.
Oh, okay. You had
I had my Vietnam veterans hat on, and theoretically, at least, I would not have been in that line if I wasn't a veteran, because they're feeding us free.
Okay.
At the Golden Corral. It's the Veterans Day celebration for the Golden Corral. Okay. That's why they had all the military stuff there.
Okay.
So I finally told him, "Look, all right, man, I'll do it." So when I got there, he interviewed me, and they want you to be tested for a whole bunch of stuff. And Reed got that disability on hearing.
Mm-hmm.
So they want you to do the hearing. They want to know about diabetes. Diabetes is a big thing for Vietnam. Prostate cancer is a big thing. And PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Look, Angel," I said, "you're a nice guy. I appreciate what you're doing." He said, "Look, the reason that we've got the stuff we've got, as much as we've got for veterans, is essentially because of Vietnam veterans and how things have been upgraded because of the way they were treated when they came home. And so nobody's given anybody anything. If you get anything, it's what's due you. So
that's right.
You need to go through this." So I did. I did everything he asked me to do. And by taking advantage of, I actually went through a class. Now, this is hard to believe. I'm almost embarrassing to say this. Mm-hmm. I found out that we blew up the POL in Vietnam. Why I never figured that out, I don't know. Because if the Viet Cong would have blown it up, that guy that panicked and was screaming would have been right. We'd all been history.
Mm-hmm.
Because there had been no reason for the Viet Cong to stop. Why would they compromise all of that stuff? Because we're basically, we have weapons available to us, but nobody there has weapons where I'm at.
Okay.
We have protection all around us and for miles out in front of us and above us. So there would be no reason for the Viet Cong to stop. If they'd have compromised all those other people, then we're history.
Mm.
So I learned that after I started taking advantage of what the VA had to offer, which was very helpful. I mean, we were never told that we blew it up ourselves, but we had to have.
Mm.
It's the only way. There is no other explanation. After it was explained to me and, you know, all of the stuff, I mean, it was clear.
And you don't know if it was planned that way or if it was an accident or was it.
Oh, it had to have been an accident. Nobody would have blown that up. That'd be like treason.
Yeah.
Almost. I mean, probably would have been just as bad. Probably would have been some kind of thing where you'd have been, could have been, should have been shot by a firing squad or something. But anyway, so I learned that. So that was memorable.
I bet. Well, what about a funny story that
A funny
something
story
that only could happen in the military?
in the military. Well, Mary, now, while I was in Vietnam, you got to remember I was not responsible. And I have to this day two laminated things where they had to get me out of jail in Suu Kyi Village. And I was called by the people on the base where I lived, I was called the Suu Kyi Kid. Now, Suu Kyi Village was off limits, but I spent the majority, I was in Suu Kyi Village all the time. So I was in a lot of different vehicles to get there. I actually rode in a Vietnamese garbage truck. I was in a Korean ice cream truck. And I rode about every kind of vehicle possible. I was one time hitchhiking, and a convoy of the 173rd Airborne picked me up. So I rode with them. So all of that was, some of it was funny at the time. I was one time, I was arrested in Suu Kyi Village, and they were set to deal with me, and somebody threw the paperwork away. I knew some military policemen, and I would trade them food, stolen food from the dining room for protection in the village. So somebody, they knew that I had been arrested. I mean, the people, they had to get me. So my commander and his first sergeant were all set to deal with me, but then the paperwork was thrown away. Or they got lost, was what they couldn't find the paperwork, and I wouldn't admit it, which I didn't have to. Can't make you admit it. It's got rights, even in there. So the commander actually said to me, "Don't let me catch you again." Something to that effect. And I said, "Don't worry, sir, you won't." Well, just a few days later, of course, they had me. So I actually came back after Vietnam. I'd been in the military 2.5 years, and I was the same rank I was when I'd been in 6 weeks. So I wasn't doing well, rank-wise.
Well, how
But I
do
did ride a lot of vehicles in Vietnam. And I
Yeah.
rode.
The ice cream truck.
Yeah, I was in a Korean ice cream truck.
How do you feel like your military experience affects your life today?
Well, I'm a big fan of the military. I have a lot of regard for the military. I just wasn't responsible when I was there. So I think it's helped focus me. It's helped me understand some of the issues. I think all of us were upset about the when we pulled out of Afghanistan and left those hundreds of millions of dollars worth of weapons. And somebody put up a sign on Facebook. They showed, we left those deuce and a halves and all those weapons and tanks and everything. And then somebody put up a sign and says, "This is the same bunch that wants you to turn in your 9mm." So I have a lot of regard for the military. I'm actually sponsoring a guy who's a special operations soldier at Fort Bragg. So he keeps me up a little bit about what's going on. And, but I, you know, I'm, I think it's a great thing, the military, and just I have a lot of regard for it. I just wish I'd have been different when I was there, but you can't do anything about the past.
That's right. So your military service, how did that play into who you are today?
Well, I think it's like everything else. When you inventory your life or responsible, I see all the people that tried to, well, I'll tell you a story. You got time for another story?
Sure.
Well, when I was in Vietnam, you got to remember, I was very young. I was a few years ago, we were having a little breakfast for my oldest granddaughter, and I think she was 20, and she was getting ready to go to Spain, I think for the second time by herself for school, and the rest of the kids were already there or something. I thought, gosh, I said, she's awful young to be going to Spain by herself. And then I thought, well, hell, I was in Vietnam at that age, and she's way more responsible than me. But here's a story. I probably, this is going to sound a little bit braggadocio, but I probably was as good as I ran into of speaking Vietnamese for the length of time I've been there. I picked up the language pretty well. You got to remember, I was in the village a lot, right? Where I wasn't supposed to be, so I was dealing with Vietnamese. You can't look at them and tell the difference between the South Vietnamese and the North Vietnamese. They look the same. So and the older people couldn't talk to you in English. So if you're going to talk to them, you had to pretty much talk in Vietnamese. Well, anyway, they shipped in every day some locals onto the base to work. Just like if at like at Fort Bragg, which now I guess it's called Fort Liberty, but they have people that are civil servants that work there. Well, like Rick Laura, do you remember him?
I don't.
Okay, well, he's retired from the Marine Corps, but he continued to work for the Marines as a civilian. So he was a civilian employee, but he worked for the Marines. So they had Vietnamese that came on the base that worked, and so maybe like 15 or 20 of those people that came on the bus every day worked in the dining room, helped there with whatever their job might be. Well, there was a guy, never forgot his name. His name was Sergeant Whalen. I remember that, Whelan. And he'd been in the Air Force 23 years. He's a good guy. He's from Alabama. He never messed with anybody, never mistreated anybody. He was just a good guy. So one day, I've never forgot this conversation, just shows how far off I was. He said, Mitchell, he said, you know, it was almost like it wasn't like he was going to start to cry, but he had that voice like he was just resigned, like, you know, it's just, this doesn't make any sense to me. And so the voice he had, he said, you know, Mitchell, he said, it's just a shame. He said that I can't trust you because he said it would change my job a lot if I could put you in charge of the civilians that come to work every day, because he said you can talk to them and understand them better than anybody here.
Wow.
And it just make my life so much easier. But he said, I can't do it because I can't trust you. He said, you don't tell them what you might do. But he wasn't saying it like it was in my face. It was like, you know, he was just making a point. It wasn't like he's going to do anything about it. And I thought to myself, well, you old fool. If you'd have went home when you're supposed to, you got your 20 years in. What are you doing around here? Why aren't you back in Alabama hanging out? You wouldn't have to worry about it. So I was just so far off. It didn't dawn on me that he was exactly right. It would have been a great job for me. It would have been a great contribution to him and his in the operation. Would have been a great job, you know, just supervising the civilians and, you know, helping them get where they're supposed to be for that day and the job and whatever it is. But I was just so far off, I didn't catch on to it. So that's always stuck in my mind.
Did that change the way you, like, did it change the way you show up at work today, looking back
Yeah,
on who?
I think, yes, I think all that, I think that has always those things. Yes, I do. I do, because once I got sober, I made a diligent run at the work world. So you'd have to, I mean, it'd be impossible not to separate those things and to say that it didn't have any influence, because surely it did. You know, one of the best ways of making amends for this, it's not the only way, but one of the best ways of cleaning up your past is to live to good effect today.
Yes, absolutely. Well, if you knew of somebody who wanted to join the military today, what advice would you want to give them?
I would tell them to, I'm well aware of the fact that a lot of people are very disillusioned with today's military. I think Reed is. Say he talks about the military about like he does the grapevine. I think he's very disillusioned with today's military as he understands that. I think you're putting women in charge of some ships and stuff he didn't like. But I don't know enough about that to feel that way. Now, I do know I'm real close to my brother-in-law, closer to my brother-in-law than I am my brother. And my brother-in-law is retired from the Air Force. And he's in the same boat as Reed. He's very disillusioned with today's military because he's got a. What would that be to him? It doesn't matter. But there was a young man who was struggling, and Stan was trying to help him and mentor him a little bit. And I said, well, because I told my sister, well, why doesn't he go in the military? That'd be a great way. And she said, well, I just don't think he could take it. Well, I mentioned it to Stan. I said, why don't you work with him and send him off to the military? He said, well, I wouldn't put anybody in the military today. It's gotten so far off that I just wouldn't send anybody there today. But what I would do, I know a guy, I see him at daytime mass. I go to mass every morning. And I know a guy who's a recently retired lieutenant colonel from the Army. I would refer him to talk to Matt, to get some, just kind of, what would you call that? Seasoned advice, maybe somebody that knows a lot more about it than I do. But I'm a big fan of that. I mean, if you don't have a trade or any education or any family money, you go in there and they take care of everything for you. If they give you a job you don't like, you can get another job. You might not get it like you would in civilian life, but they have a process. It's called cross training. You just go through the procedures, they'll get you another job. And the whole thing is, I've always found very overblown. People are afraid of what I guess the polite term for it would be the chain of command, like the military. There is no such thing as not doing what you're told. That's probably true in the long run, but if you do your job, you might not even hear anything from your boss. It's not any different in your job. I mean, you might have somebody that micromanages you. You might have somebody that, leaves you completely alone if you're. The only thing is, you have to live where they tell you. But even with that, you get choices where you want to put in for. So you can literally get out of the military as a very young man or woman and have a pension and benefits for the rest of your life that are outstanding. Plus, it's the country needs it.
That's right. That's right. We're short
So I'm
on
a fan.
military, fit military especially.
Yes, that's exactly right.
So I guess what you're saying is if somebody is thinking about joining the military, they would get the most benefit if they do as they're told and then make, follow orders and work hard
That's right. And they should talk, check it out before they go. It's gotten harder. It's got merits if the big view, it's not much different than buying a new car. It's harder for people selling cars to lie to you today more than ever because you have so much information available to you on social media. Well, it's harder for in the old days, they would lie. Like I had that recruiter that I went in under, he told me that if I would bring some. They were trying to get women into the Air Force at that time. Big push. And he said, for every woman young girl that I got to come up and talk to him, even if they didn't join, he would give me like these things called latrine passes. So when everybody had to clean the bathroom, I didn't have to do it. Well, I told that to my dad, and he said, well, he told you that, but there ain't no such thing. I'll guarantee you that. There isn't. But it's gotten harder for them to do that kind of stuff today. So I would say they should talk with someone like the only one I know like locally that I could just make arrangements for would be like Matt, the retired lieutenant colonel. That's a very high rank. I said, Matt, would you talk? There's a young man thinking about going in the Army. Could you mind, taking him out to lunch or something and answering his questions?
That
That's what
sounds
I
good.
would do.
Anything else you want to tell people who are listening?
No, other than it's a really good deal.
All
I
right.
mean, I'm a big fan of the military.
Well, I really appreciate you spending time with me and helping me to understand more about veterans, Steve.
My good pleasure. Anytime.
Thank you. Thanks again for tuning into the Voices of Vets podcast today. If you haven't done so already, make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any of our episodes of real vets and their stories. And don't forget to visit our website, voicesofvets.us, where you can check out the photo gallery and more.